Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. August 6th, 1945.
The White House has just made an important announcement on the war. And to bring you this story, we interrupt our program.
The world has never been the same since the news that crackled over the radio from Washington 75 years ago this week.
I have just returned from the White House, where it has just been announced that the United States is now using an atomic bomb, the most powerful explosive yet developed.
The target, Hiroshima, Japan.
The B-29 dropped its load of atomic death, which exploded with a force equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. A few days later, the second atomic terror was loosed on Nagasaki. No section of Hiroshima, a city of over 300,000, remained unscathed. For many days after the actual bombing, thousands continued to die of burns and shock. Latest reports from the Japanese say that 126,000 died as the result of the damage done by the single bomb that blasted the city.
Advisors to President Harry Truman told him it was only the only way to bring the Second World War to an end.
We must constitute ourselves trustees of this new force to prevent its misuse and to turn it into the channels of service to mankind. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us.
He says us there, but after the bombings of Hiroshima and 3 days later of Nagasaki, Truman made sure there was no us in making the call to use future bombs. Truman wanted his finger to be the only one on the button, and that has been the stance for all presidents in the 75 years since. But is that too much power for one finger? America's nuclear policy hasn't been at the forefront much in the decades since the end of the Cold War. It was only brought up once for a few minutes last summer during a Democratic presidential debate. But our guest today says the current state of nuclear policy is a disaster waiting to happen. Tom Colina is director of policy at the Plowshares Fund. That's a global anti-nuclear proliferation organization. He has also written, along with former Defense Secretary William Perry, The Button, The New Nuclear Arms Race and Presidential Power from Truman to Trump. And they will be speaking by remote to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte this Thursday, the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. And in advance of that, Tom Colina joins us remotely from New Hampshire on this Politics Monday. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Great to be here.
Thank you for doing this. Let me mention again that you will be appearing virtually on Thursday, the 75th anniversary of the bomb drop over Hiroshima, at the World Affairs Council of Charlotte at 2 p.m. This is usually a luncheon that very few people other than members get to go to, but this time anybody can watch that talk with you, and I think Secretary Perry will be part of that.
That's right.
By registering online at worldaffairscharlotte.org. And we'll put that on our website. So let's start at the very beginning here with regard to nuclear policy. Although the only president who has ever used a nuclear weapon in the United States was Harry Truman, he didn't explicitly order the military to drop those bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He merely gave verbal approval to the military to drop those bombs. That would be correct, right?
Yes. I mean, in those days, the presidents were less directly involved with military matters. I think there was always a general assumption that if the bomb was successful, and in the first nuclear test in July, 75 years ago, that was confirmed, the Trinity test in New Mexico. So there's a general assumption that if the bomb worked, it was going to be used in Japan.
Mm. So the atomic bomb was developed in absolute secrecy. The Manhattan Project, which took place in Tennessee, few knew about it, including Harry Truman, until he ascended to the office of the presidency on the death of Franklin Roosevelt. And evidently, as I read about this yesterday, and as you will tell us, very little thought had been given to how or under what circumstances this weapon might be used. It was just another weapon in an arsenal of weapons controlled by the military in the United States. So what made Truman begin to see that maybe this weapon was just not, this was not a howitzer or a rifle or even a tank.
That's right. They had to figure out how to think about nuclear weapons in a different way. And it didn't come to them right away. I mean, I think, Harry Truman, President Truman, for his case, as you said, he was only told about the bomb when he became president. He only had a few months to figure out what all this meant and what he would do with it once he had it. So for President Truman, I don't think he really understood the power of the bomb and what made it different, as you say, than any other weapon until it was used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Well, I was going to say that was going to be my next question. I mean, when he said, you can go ahead and use this, if you think it's going to end World War II, go ahead and drop it. He had no idea the extent of the damage and the scale of the death toll at the time. Was it after Nagasaki that he decided, wait a minute, somebody has to be in charge?
I think it's when he was when he heard that there was a third bomb being prepared and that the military was thinking of using this again over Japan. He said no. He explicitly said, and this was the beginning of presidential sole authority, that no nuclear weapons shall be used unless I, the president, the civilian authority, explicitly authorizes it. And this was the beginning of sole authority. This is why we call them the president's weapons, because literally no one else other than the president can authorize their use. And this is different than any other weapon in the U.S. arsenal. And this has been true ever since. For the past 75 years, every U.S. president has had this sole authority. But what was unusual about this, I mean, he said, I'm going to take that authority away from the military and make sure it's purely civilian. But he only gave it to one civilian, himself, right? He didn't share it with Congress, which of course is the other civilian authority. And that's the recommendation we make in our book. If we want to reduce some of the dangers here, the president could share that authority with Congress.
And we're going to talk about why that perhaps has happened over the last 75 years, why the president was in charge and only the president was in charge. Under President Eisenhower and there was an ongoing threat of nuclear attack on the United States by the Soviet Union and vice versa, a policy was developed that empowered certain military officers, I understand, to order a nuclear attack without the president's direct consent. But that changed again during the Kennedy administration. Did Eisenhower, was he open to having the military make this decision because he came from the ranks of the military and he trusted them?
Well, it's a complicated story, but if part of presidential sole authority is the authority to delegate that authority. And so Eisenhower delegated that authority in part to some of the frontline commanders in Europe, for example. There was a fear that if things moved too quickly, there would simply be no time for the president to be brought into that conversation. And so some of this authority was delegated to officers closer to the action. But that brought real dangers, which, for example, the Kennedy administration was very concerned about, is they didn't want the president out of the loop. Hmm. And that's why they tried to accelerate the decision-making process with the president involved, which is when we got this thing called the football, which is this briefcase that a military attaché carries 24/7, 365, and follows the president everywhere he goes. And everything the president would need to order nuclear war is in that briefcase.
Hmm. The Kennedy administration put into place some policies that I'm told are some of which are still classified, so we don't really know everything about what they put in. But what do we know about that system and how it functions today?
Sure. So we have, as I said, the football, this briefcase right. That follows the president. In that briefcase is a communications device of some kind, the nuclear plans that the president would need to look at to see which kind of attack he wanted to order. And then there are codes in there where the president would identify himself to the war room in the Pentagon to make sure that this really is the president making this order. And once the president decides what he wants to do and gives that order to the Pentagon, it's just minutes until those orders move their way down the chain of command and go to missile control launch officers, in land-based ballistic missile sites, on submarines, and at bomber bases, because we have three different ways the United States can deliver nuclear weapons. And the first ones to launch would probably be the land-based missiles. Those could launch within literally minutes.
During the Kennedy and Eisenhower administrations, did we have nuclear weapons other than ICBMs? We didn't have them on submarines at that time, did we? We didn't have them in the field. They couldn't be mounted on a missile launcher in the field, could they?
We have. So back when
we do now, but back then
it was just on bombers. But then in the 60s, nuclear weapons came on the land-based ballistic missiles, and soon thereafter the submarines. So we've had them dispersed across those forces for quite some decades.
So we talk about the button. There is no button, but the nuclear football is probably the closest thing to that. But how the Kennedy administration was well before the age of the internet and well before the age of cell phone technology. How did that device, that box, transmit instructions from the president, wherever he happened to be, to the people in the Pentagon and then to the various headquarters that would have access to a bomb or a missile?
The military had their ways of communicating at the time. There was telexes, there was various things that they would use wirelessly to communicate orders. And those procedures evolved over time until today, when, you know, we don't actually know what's in that briefcase in terms of a communications device. But we know that they were assured that they will be able to communicate those orders from the president. But there's always that area of doubt, right? If you're talking about communicating during a nuclear war, obviously that's something we've never tried to do. That's a very complicated thing. Right. And so a lot of this is theoretical. We don't really know whether in a situation where nuclear war is actually raging, how communication would be affected, and certainly would not be a pretty picture.
I wonder if a nuclear war can rage, because once you launch and the other side launches, I'm not sure that could be start and finish right there. I guess it should be noted, if we haven't already made it pretty evident, that control over our nuclear weapons in the United States is governed by policy and not by law. It was one man's decision, Harry Truman's decision, to make the president in charge of these awesome weapons, and it's never changed. It seems to me that the ability to launch a nuclear weapon or drop a nuclear bomb is tantamount to declaring war, because once you do, you have declared war, and that power lies with the Congress of the United States. So why has Congress never written a bill or challenged this or put an amendment to the Constitution in the Constitution that says we will consult with the president on dropping these weapons?
That's a great question. Part of it is back in 1945, when Truman took this authority to himself. Again, no one really understood the extent of it, what was really going on. It was not seen for what it was as a presidential power grab, because, of course, you know, this was a brand new power, nuclear mm-hmm. weapons. It was a brand new authority. No one fully understood how it should happen. And so they were kind of making it up as they went along. And so Truman took this authority for himself. As you said, it was not approved by Congress. It is not in the Constitution. It was simply something that Truman wanted to do for himself. And then after that, administration policy was declared that the president shall be the sole decider when it comes to nuclear weapons. And I think part of Congress not complaining about this is I'm not sure Congress wanted that authority.
Okay, I was going to ask you, it's been 75 years since Harry Truman made that decision. They've had a lot of time to talk about this, but Congress does this a lot, bats heads. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about buying power, the history of boycotts, and do they work when they're associated with political causes or politicians. Lawrence Glickman, is professor of history and American studies at Cornell University and the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. And Americus Reed is professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Glickman, you say that you have a theory of which types of boycotts work. Talk about that.
I would say two very different types of boycotts tend to succeed. And one is a very local kind of boycott. If your clientele surrounds a workplace that has done something controversial, those can often work. A lot of the so-called labor boycotts of the 1880s occurred in working class neighborhoods. And if a bakery or a brewery, say, didn't hire union workers or paid workers low wages, and a boycott was organized, those would often succeed because the clients of that bakery or that brewery lived in the neighborhood. They tended to be working class, and they tended to extend solidarity in that way. It's a lot harder to do that at the national level, however, because you have consumers entering the picture for all sorts of reasons. But at the national or even international level, I think the kind that work are not necessarily going to be economic in nature, but political in nature. They're going to raise political consciousness about an issue. And I think a good example of that would be the United Farm Workers Great Boycott, which really led a lot of Americans to be aware of the really, you know, awful conditions in agriculture, mostly in California, that migrant farm workers were experiencing and so forth. A lot of Americans participated in those boycotts. I wouldn't necessarily say they won the day economically, but I think they did make this issue a national hot button issue. And I think there are so many other boycotts we can think of that have worked at that level, maybe not economically impacted the company, but raised an issue that we now, you know, there's more consciousness about as a whole.
I want to go back to something, Dr. Reed, that you were talking about in the last segment for a moment, and that was the role that self-concepts play. Yes. In making buying decisions. In other words, consumers often buy or don't buy products because of how they view themselves.
That's right.
And they want to be true to themselves. Politics and political points of view would seem to be among the strongest self-identifiers. You are either a Democrat or a Republican, you're a conservative, you're a liberal, you yep. like Trump or you don't like Trump. So given that, would companies be wise to either steer clear of politics and policy altogether or embrace the Ben and Jerry's model and say, this is what we are, this is what we stand for. If you agree, you're one of us, come buy our ice cream.
Yeah, I have a pretty strong view on this, Mike, and I want to pull it back into what Larry's talking about too. It's like when he was talking about local, you're talking about deeply connected things that are close and tightly affiliated with the person. And so when you make that decision as a company, you're making a bit of a moral decision and an economic decision. It's like at the CEO top level, I'm deciding like this is what's important and this is what I stand for. And I'm making that decision realizing as a savvy marketer that I'm going to attract people who I want to attract that I think are going to be loyal and I'm going to live with that. So when Nike came out and said, you know, we're going to be behind Colin Kaepernick and these protests, they were making a bold statement. But they understood that from a demographic perspective that they were attracting for this type of argument a certain type of customer. And they were perfectly okay with not attracting those who would not align themselves with that value. And it's so, in some sense, it's just marketing, because marketing by definition is talking to a segment and not necessarily trying to talk to everybody. So you're hoping that segment is going to be loyal and will stay with you. And one way to do that is to connect on political identity, which is very, very powerful. I mean, in the 2016 election, you could see the correlation between whether or not the Democrat or the Republican candidate won based on the concentration of either Whole Foods markets or Cracker Barrels in the environment. So, I mean, this is clearly a powerful identity. And I think it's a smart decision. If you understand your customer and who they are, then you're just simply saying that I'm going to really lean in on my ability to try to create alignment with their self-concept, their identity, and their desire to self-express and be in this tent with me.
So it's also a way to tell consumers who you are. It's a way to carve out your niche in the marketplace.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Can I just add that I think Nike is a really, really interesting example, because I think they're a good example of a brand that sells shoes and other athletic stuff, but really sells a lifestyle, as Americus is saying. You know, it is interesting because, you know, Nike ran into trouble in the late 90s, early 2000s because of their reliance on sweatshop labor. And there was also the example, the famous, possibly apocryphal example of Michael Jordan saying that, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too, so I don't want to, you know, get involved in the Harvey Gantt race and, you know, and this sort of thing. So it is interesting the way in which when a company does establish that brand, they could be accused of hypocrisy if they're seen as violating that spirit.
Well, Michael Jordan, it wasn't the CEO of Nike. He was just one of their key spokespeople and a very influential person in among those who would buy anybody's sneakers, much less a Nike's. And I suppose it makes a difference if you are Jeff Bezos and you own both Amazon and the Washington Post and you're the billionaire owner, you can make a unilateral decision. But if you're just a CEO, you work the pleasure of the board of directors. So when you make a decision to support a cause or to not support a cause or to support a politician, should you be getting the input of the board? Should you muzzle yourself if they aren't on the same page, Americus?
Well, I think you should be getting as much information as you can. It's about business intelligence. You should have a sense of what is going to be the impact if I lean in on this. I think that going back to a previous example, when Chick-fil-A, S. Truett Cathy came out with the statements about the definition of marriage should be between a man and a woman, suddenly Chick-fil-A was in the hot spot, if you will, because now we're looking at a very upset LGBTQ community who's saying, like, what does this happen? You know, why this is terrible. And we saw boycotts and boycotts. But it was interesting because if you look at Chick-fil-A, they are a fantastically successful company. They're not open on Sunday. So they're giving up their Sunday sales, 52 days of sales a year. They're giving up because they want to profess these strong Christian values. But at the same time, at some point, the decision was made that, you know, we take a look at what's going on here. And there's a lot of money left on the table if we just completely ignore this LGBTQ community. And quite honestly, it doesn't really have anything to do with definition of marriage. Doesn't really have anything to do with our chicken, really. And we want to keep selling the chicken. So they pulled back and really kind of walked back. They didn't give up those values, but they walked back and said, you know, we're going to stay out of this political conversation. And so sometimes it makes sense to not be involved in it. Other times, as Larry's saying, it's just going to be part of the C-suite's leadership. Like, this is who I am at the top, and I'm going to live with this decision, and I'm going to be okay with it. So I think, you know, brands and values are going to continue to be important. And I think even in a pandemic, what I've noticed is that people are by themselves self-quarantined, thinking about what's important to me. So brands better come out and say, hey, here's a reason why you should continue to support me when this pandemic is over. And one way to do that is to like Larry's saying, focus in on political ideology and other types of values.
A recent report from Advertising Week called the 2020 Survival Guide for Brands found that although 15% of consumers have increased their shopping with a brand that's taken a political stance, 29% have stopped buying from that brand. So one-fifth have implored family or friends to stop supporting that brand. 16% have posted on social media about the brand, and about the same percentage have signed petitions against the company. And it is educated, liberal, and wealthy consumers who are most likely to boycott, according to Advertising Week. Dr. Glickman, how should brands view and use that information?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, so much of this, I think, is guesswork, and it's really sometimes hard to determine what the impact is. And, to me, the key is getting back to, I think, the point that Americus has been making about the importance of establishing a brand outside of whatever it is that you sell. I think that's so important in the modern world and the modern economy, because I do think consumers, it's not necessarily always a strictly political decision, but I think Americus is right that it has to do with the identity that people want. And a lot of Nike's advertising wasn't really about politics. It was about, are you the kind of person who's going to just do it? Are you going to be the kind of person who's going to, you know, extend yourself to the limits? And of course, a lot of us want to think whether we are or not, we want to feel we're that way. So I think it is a tricky business for companies to navigate, because those issues are so important.
Easier for some companies, I would think, than others, because the same study reports that young people, Gen Zers and millennials, want corporations to use their influence to affect political and cultural change. Older people do not. So America's Read, if you're Cadillac or you are Mercedes, should you steer clear or take positions that would favor an older political point of view? And if you're Lululemon or Nike, you go with somebody who's younger? Is that what you do?
Well, I think it's a short-term and long-term strategy. I think in some sense, if you know who your customer is and who you're trying to attract, that's going to help guide the answer to that. So one thing you have to keep in mind, though, Mike, is that, and this, I'm not saying this to be grotesque, but older consumers will eventually die. So at some point, you're going to have to talk to a younger consumer. And if, just like Larry's saying, these younger consumers, they have a kind of different perspective. They want to know what do you stand for? How are you treating the environment? How do you treat your labor, your workers? All of these things matter to them, because at the end of the day, you might have two products, Mike, that are almost the same on all their ability to deliver on features. And the tipping balance might just be that, well, this one other product is just more like me. I just feel like emotionally I can connect with it on my values. And that might be the difference in buying versus not buying. So it's very powerful.
Is that what's at work here in the Black Lives Matter movement? We have companies like Nike and Twitter and Netflix and Citigroup who quickly aligned themselves with that movement. Have they determined that that is where their bread is buttered, with supporters of that movement? Or is it more of a moral decision or the desire to be on the right side of history, Dr. Reed?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, right? It's hard to disentangle what's the decision calculus. Is it moral or is it economic? I think in some senses, we're in a moment right now where, I mean, you look at companies, they're not able to sort of stand on the sidelines anymore and kind of give a wishy-washy answer if they're asked about George Floyd or other kinds of issues around social justice. I think right now it's like the companies have to take a stand and just live with what that stand is. You look at, you know, companies that are changing their packaging. Aunt Jemima went away recently because of the negative stereotyping perceptions of the brand and the product and all these kinds of things. Washington Redskins just changed the name of their entire football team to the Washington Football Team. I mean, this is tremendous change that you're seeing now. It's a massive flashpoint in time. And Larry can speak to this because he's the guru and the historian on this aspect. But I've never seen anything like this in terms of there's so much powerful salience around the movement and how Black Lives Matters has really kind of met that intersection.
Yeah, this change happened without a boycott, Dr. Glickman. I mean, this happened just because companies thought, this is a movement and we got to get on the right side of that movement. And we need to do it fast.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think boycott is one manifestation of politics, but there are other manifestations, and seeing millions of people in the streets demonstrating and also, you know, public opinion polls showing that despite what, you know, Donald Trump and others thought might happen, that the movement for Black Lives is very popular. And, you know, surveys are showing that most Americans support it. I don't think companies are acting cynically, but I do think that, you know, they did want to be seen as standing for these humane values. I think many of them have done that, not necessarily because of fear of setting off a boycott, but because they wanted to be positioned for what they took the modern world to be. Mm.
When a company or a CEO takes a stand on a moral issue or an ethical issue, how fine a line are they walking? I mean, do they have to really make sure that if they are held accountable, it will be discovered that they are not only talking the talk, but they're walking the walk, Dr. Reed?
That's 100% correct. I think that, you know, consumers are smart and they understand a few things. One is they're going to look at your footprint over time and see, like, what have you been doing before all of this hit? And are you a Johnny come lately? Or have you been like investing in these kinds of social justice issues over time? That's number one. And then number two, moving forward, once you take that stand, to build on what Larry's saying, it's all about authenticity, right? What do I do? It's not enough to just simply black out your social media and say, okay, hashtag you know, Black Lives Matter. We want to know, what are you doing? Are you donating to causes? Are you raising awareness? Are you creating movements? Are you creating initiatives in your company? Are you going into the community and helping the community address the issues that are really behind some of the challenges that create a George Floyd situation? And so, you know, all of this stuff is going to be basically available to consumers, and they can find it out very easily because of that fantastic thing called the Google machine. they're going to be able to find out whether or not you're just giving window dressing or actually serious about doing something about the issue.
In the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Dr. Glickman, you wrote about, quote, the coordinated economic attacks on the National Rifle Association from credit card companies and delivery services, insurers, car rental companies, airlines, and others. And at the time, I remember this, it seemed as though this was going to have a crippling effect on the NRA, and it was going to maybe change America's love affair with guns. Well, the NRA is still with us, and we still have plenty of guns to go around. So was all that for naught?
I don't think so. Again, as a historian, I take the long-term perspective, and, you know, an organization like the NRA had acquired massive political power, and it still has a lot of political power. But, you know, I would say that its reputation has been dinged a little bit by this, and that who knows what the future will hold. But I think we may look back in 50 years and say Parkland was a turning point. It's too early to say. That's one of historians' favorite sayings.
So is it, when you look back on the history of boycotts or the how boycotts may have impacted a particular cause or moral position, is it usually death by a thousand cuts over time, or is it, there's the boycott, there's the change?
Definitely usually the death by a thousand cuts, I would say. It's really rare, as I was saying, that a boycott just works, and that's the end of the story. It's usually, you know, boycotts are part of broader political campaigns and so forth, and so it's just one element of many.
We're talking about the impact of boycotts on politics and politicians and whether they work and how they work and why they would work or why they don't often work, because they don't often work, with Lawrence Glickman, who is a professor of history and American studies at Cornell University and the author of Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He's with us from Ithaca, and America's Read is with us from Philadelphia, where he's a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. We have more to talk about. We'll do it in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Colina is our guest, the author of The Button, The New Nuclear Arms Race and Presidential Power from Truman to Trump. The other author of that book is the former Secretary of Defense, William Perry. What are the fail-safe mechanisms governing our use of nuclear weapons? Are there any?
When it comes to presidential authority, the only fail-safe is not to elect a president that you don't trust. And we didn't do that, quite frankly, in this case. President Trump, I think by any definition, is not someone that you would want to trust with that authority. And again, the only fail-safe was the election system. So if we can't trust the election system to not elect presidents that we don't trust as authority, then we need to change the authority. And that's why the fail-safe has to change. And so to us, slowing that decision process down and having it not just be one person, but sharing it with Congress, for example, is the way to go.
And although President Trump is highly erratic in his behavior when it comes to presidential norms, there are people on the other side of that who may have felt uneasy about Hillary Clinton's finger being on the button. So the same holds true. It shouldn't be one person's finger on the button, no matter who that person is. There's a section of your book called the Atomic Titanic, which sums this up pretty well. You say that on the Titanic, just prior to its striking the iceberg on April the 15th, 1912, everything was fine. They were dining in luxury. The band was playing. People were having a wonderful time. And suddenly, without warning, bang, they're in the middle of sinking in the middle of the cold Atlantic. Is that how you see the world in the nuclear age? We're all on board the Titanic rearranging the deck chairs and then suddenly, bang, we're not.
It is. I mean, obviously, excuse me, that's an analogy, but I think it holds firm in that the public concern is simply not on nuclear weapons today. You know, it used to be, you know, during the Cold War and certainly back in the 80s, there was a lot of public concern about nuclear weapons. Then the Cold War ended around the end of the 80s and the 90s. The arsenal started coming down. And I think the public assumed that this problem would take care of itself and went on to worry about other very important issues, whether it be climate change or racial inequality or gun control or what have you. The problem is that the weapons never went away and the policies never really changed. And now we've left it to the bureaucrats, those with a vested interest in these weapons remaining in the arsenals. And their answer is, we want to continue these things and we want to rebuild them and we want more of them. And so now we're at a place where we're seeing a renaissance of the bomb, where the United States is moving into a new program to spend over $1 trillion to rebuild the nuclear arsenal. And I think we have to ask the question of why are we doing this? Wouldn't we be safer with less? And I think the previous Cold War tells us, yes, less is better. Let's not go back and do that again.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it doesn't make any sense to me. And maybe it does make sense if you know something about it, which I don't. But these missiles, these ICBM missiles, we are, as you said, in the process of wanting to rebuild our arsenal. We have these missiles sitting in silos. They've been sitting there for years and they haven't ever run. It's like having a brand new car in the garage. You've never driven it. Is there some chance that it won't drive when you turn on the ignition? Is that why we want to rebuild?
No, it's more that when these missiles are built, they're built with a certain life expectancy, if you will, that they'll last about 30, 40 years. And then certain parts might become unreliable. So I don't have a problem with building a new system after a certain period of time if you need it. The question is, do you need it? And I think now is the time before we rush to spend $100 billion of taxpayer money on a new fleet of missiles, nuclear armed missiles. We need to ask the question, why do we have them? Do we still need them? Because the last time we made that decision to build these things, we were in the Cold War.
Right.
And so we're in a very different time now. Certainly if we're focused on the danger of accidental launch and blundering into nuclear war, these land-based ballistic missiles are the ones you want to get rid of, because they're the ones that the president would worry about losing if he didn't launch right away.
How many do we have? How many nuclear weapons does the president have at his disposal at any given time?
The United States has about 6,000 nuclear weapons in various stages of launch readiness. If the president were to launch everything that he could in the first few minutes, it would be about 1,000. And then over some hours could launch the rest.
Well, what's the destructive nature of those? In other words, what would 1,000 nuclear missiles do to the world? One would presume, and I could be wrong, but one would presume that an attack on the United States would be coming from one country, either Russia or India, which is highly unlikely, or some other country that has nuclear weapons. So how many weapons would we need to respond?
Not that many, right? And if you think about it, of how many weapons would it take to end civilization on the planet? Mm-hmm. It's probably a few hundred. You know, that's what the latest climate science will tell you.
So we have 6,000. What do the Russians have? What do the Indians have? What do the other nuclear armament nations have?
So the United States and Russia each have about 6,000. Everyone else is in the low few hundreds. Even China has about 300 nuclear weapons, and only a small fraction of those could reach the United States. So the United States and Russia are in a league by themselves. And most other countries look at us and say, what are you doing? Yeah. What are you possibly going to do with 6,000 nuclear weapons? And remember, these arsenals have come down by 80% from the Cold War highs. You know, together, we used to have 10 times that many. So it's really kind of insane to think about the levels of nuclear weapons that we had. And it makes you realize that there's not a lot of rationality going into this thinking. There's a lot of politics. There's a lot of posturing. There's a lot of trying to look tough and make sure that, you know, the public sees presidential decisions in a certain way. but there isn't necessarily a lot of logic behind the decision making.
Is the real threat today from a dirty bomb brought in a suitcase to Grand Central Station versus a nuclear attack by a nation state?
The biggest threat, and I do worry about, you know, a terrorist smuggling a bomb in, that kind of thing. But to me, the biggest threat is blundering into a large scale nuclear war.
Okay.
That a president could do because of sole authority, because of first use authority, and because of the danger of a false alarm. If an attack is incoming, the president will not know it's a real attack or a false attack until it lands. And if the president decides to launch before it lands, they may have just started nuclear war by mistake. To me, that is the greatest danger we face, because it would be the end of civilization here in Russia and for most of the rest of the world.
Wow. So the real solution is to get rid of these weapons, and that's probably not likely in our lifetimes. Would you say that's even remotely possible?
I think it's very remote, which is why the book does not talk about that.
Right.
And certainly we support the global elimination of nuclear weapons, if I think that could be done in a negotiated way. But it's a long-term goal. So the immediate thing we would like to do is reduce the risk of the use of nuclear weapons, particularly by accident. So that's why we want to reduce the danger of blundering into war by removing sole authority for the president, by saying we won't use them first, and by getting rid of the land-based ballistic missiles that make an accidental attack so dangerous.
Well, let's talk about some of your recommendations then, because you say that the winner of the 2020 presidential contest, whoever it is, has an opportunity right now, a unique opportunity to reshape the nation's nuclear policy. But that president's going to face some immediate serious issues like this pandemic and the economic collapse that has resulted from it, which is likely to get worse between now and January 20th on Inauguration Day. So will that be a front and center issue, or will nuclear reshaping of our nuclear policy become a back burner issue very quickly?
Well, it's a great question, but I think all of those things can work together. For example, the next president, as you rightly say, has to deal with coronavirus in some way that's got to be more effective than the way that the current president is doing it. And is going to have to rebuild the economy, which is in serious trouble because of the coronavirus and other things. The next president will probably want to address racial inequalities in some way.
Yeah.
And climate change, for example. So let's just take those things. Those are all going to cost a lot of money. And we're spending a lot of money on nuclear weapons, as I mentioned, $1 trillion over the next 30 years. And much of that we don't need to do. So the way I see it is we have a nuclear piggy bank that the next president can break open and use that as a down payment towards these other much more pressing, important things. We're spending a lot of money on nuclear weapons that we don't need to spend. In fact, it's making us less safe, when at the same time, we have all of these other priorities we need to address. So let's take that money out of the nuclear fund, particularly the $100 billion for these new land-based ballistic missiles, and let's put that money someplace else.
So you've made all these recommendations on reshaping our nuclear policy. Let's go through some of them. End presidential sole nuclear authority, which you said several times here. Retire the football. Authorize presidential authority to launch only in retaliation to a confirmed nuclear attack on the United States or an ally that we've promised we will support. Prohibit launch on warning, prohibit first use. What would all those require, and where is that change likely to come from the president or from the Congress?
I think it's more likely to come from the president, because the president can do this in a much easier way. It's very hard for the Congress to agree on these issues.
On anything.
on anything, and particularly on these things, because they're so politicized, they're so polarized. It's hard to imagine Congress agreeing on this, although there is legislation in Congress both on ending sole authority and on no first use, and also on eliminating land-based ballistic missiles. But I think it'll be much easier if it comes from the next president. And just for example, Vice President Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, has come out with statements that are very close to no first use, for example, and has talked about the the $1 trillion being spent to rebuild the nuclear arsenal as excessive. So there's some beginnings of a policy here that we could expect better things from a Biden administration, but we'll see.
You're recommending that we retire all of our ICBMs and scale back the nuclear rebuild, which you've talked about, this idea of spending all this money to rebuild that arsenal. Don't we need ICBMs for our own protection? And particularly since North Korea is talking about developing a weapon that can go to Seattle and possibly to Washington. Don't we need ICBMs in order to respond to that?
Well, I would say as long as there are other nuclear weapons in the world, then we need a deterrent. And what that means is we need enough nuclear firepower that no one else would dare attack us. But we don't need the land-based ICBMs for that. We still have hundreds of nuclear weapons deployed at submarines at sea. And those submarines are invulnerable to attack. So even if someone attacked all of our ICBMs and took them all out in some way that is very unlikely, they would still be vulnerable to an attack from our submarines. So even without ICBMs, our land-based ballistic missiles, no country is going to be confident that they can attack the United States with nuclear weapons and get away with it. So we don't need the ICBMs for deterrence, but at the same time, they create this unacceptable risk of accidental nuclear war that is just too dangerous, and we don't need it, and it's tremendously expensive.
The START Treaty, negotiated by the Obama administration and signed by the U.S. and Russia in 2010, expires in February 2021, just after the inauguration. Renewing it for 5 years requires agreement between Washington and Moscow, and you say we should renew it. What are the chances of that happening under a second Trump administration?
Under a second Trump administration. Well, I would hope that under a second Trump administration, President Trump might try to rebuild some of the arms control structures that are lagging. But there's no indication that that's the case, right? All the indications are that President Trump is interested in tearing things down, not building them up. And he's particularly interested in tearing things down that have President Obama's name on them. The New START Treaty, Trump sees as Obama's treaty and therefore is not interested in renewing it. President Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal that was Obama's agreement. So everything we see that Obama did, Trump wants to get as far away from as possible. So it's hard to imagine him doing a 360 in his second term and all of a sudden embracing this process, but you never know.
One never knows. We have only a few seconds left, but you also recommend limiting our strategic missile defenses. I'm not sure how that works, but we don't have time to talk about it. Don't wait for treaties because we haven't got time for that. You also say engage diplomatically with North Korea and Iran. And President Trump has tried to engage with Korea, and we see where that got us. I don't know whether that's because of him or because we're being toyed with by Kim Jong-un. So what's the point of engaging with North Korea?
Well, look, I mean, you can't make progress unless you engage. And I'm probably one of the few people that supported President Trump's engagement with North Korea. Because I think leaders should talk. They should talk these things out, and engagement is good. But you have to have a plan. And the problem is that President Trump never had a plan for how to make that talk into real diplomacy. He asked for way too much way up front that the North Koreans were not willing to give. And so he basically tripped himself up.
The president of your organization, the Plowshares Fund, says if there's not nuclear disarmament, there will be proliferation. Wish we had time to talk about that, but that folds into what you've been saying, that we're on a razor's edge here, and we need to make a move sooner than later. Tom Kalina is director of policy of the Plowshares Fund and the co-author with former Secretary of Defense William Perry of The Button, The New Nuclear Arms Race and Presidential Power from Truman to Trump. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.